The letter to Philadelphia, segment number 20, on Revelation 3, verses 7 through 13. This verse is promised believers of the Philadelphia church type, which are those who live in the age of grace, that they would not have to go through the period of church history, through the period of world history, known as the tribulation era, when God's wrath is finally poured out against unbelieving, Christ-rejecting humanity. And that period of tribulation is an era that does not occur out of a vacuum, but is an era which is a direct result of a chain of historical events which precede that period of human history. And we've been looking at the key factors which create the conditions in society which bring about that period of the tribulation judgments. The key factor in the human personality is, of course, the mind of the soul. God in the Bible reveals that a person is what he thinks. Proverbs 23:7. Just as a person is physically what he eats, so he is psychologically what he believes, what he takes into the mind. Human viewpoint garbage accepted into the mind produces human viewpoint garbage concepts and actions in one's life. This is the problem with pornography, for example. Pornography has the devastating effect of being garbage into the mentality of the soul, which then creates problems for that person in his attitudes and in his external reactions. Satan has in recent centuries, therefore, been shaping the minds of people with doses of human viewpoint garbage from influential but ignorant intellectual opinion makers. These ideas are designed specifically to wean people away from the divine viewpoint thinking of the Bible, which is provided to preserve people from being victimized by Satan in this era when Satan dominates the world. These ideas are portrayed to the human race as superior knowledge over biblical beliefs. These ideas are actually preparing mankind for life in the tribulation world under the dictatorship of Satan's man, the Antichrist. These key ideas are directly against God and His will, and they will receive God's most devastating punishment in the time of the tribulation era, as well as in eternity. God, who preserves Christians from the tribulation judgments in the future, however, also now preserves believers from these concepts which are going to create that tribulation nightmare. In order for us to understand what is coming, we have to understand where it comes from. And understanding where the concepts that create the tribulation come from also preserves us now from being victimized by these concepts. Because if you are not informed on the ideas of these influential thinkers, then you won't understand how people think today and why our society operates the way it does. And you will not know how to interpret what you hear from all kinds of directions today, and how yourself not to be victimized by those ideas, as will in time the people in the tribulation be victimized. What we are talking about is actually voices from the grave which are controlling human thought today. We have looked at several. One, Immanuel Kant. He said that knowledge was basically through empiricism, through the method of empiricism, that is, through the human senses, and that consequently there was no absolute truth. What you could not grasp through your senses, you could not really know. And therefore, we're talking about things like heaven and sin and God and eternity and creation and so on, and none of those things can in any realm be areas of absolute, a certain knowledge, because we cannot secure them through the senses. Consequently, Kant's idea reversed centuries of thinking where A was different from non-A, and that there was such a thing as a cause and a consequent and a certain effect. Kant's idea established a new way of thinking, that people would not suffer the consequences of their actions. The second thinker we looked at, who speaks to us from the grave, is George Hegel. Hegel took up Kant's idea and projected into a system of thinking called the dialectic. where he was to establish truth, but it was always relative truth. A thesis faced by an antithesis, resulting in a synthesis, which became a new thesis, to be faced by a new antithesis, to make a new synthesis. And the result was that nothing was ever buttoned down. There were no absolutes of morality binding on mankind in society. This concept was then further followed by a third man who speaks to us from the grave, Charles Darwin. He declared that life forms all originated from inanimate matter by gradual evolution, not by divine creation. Consequently, man was a mere animal with no soul and could be treated and dealt with as an animal. Now the human race had come quite away from its original biblical heritage. Now there was no absolute truth. Now there was only relative truth. Now there was no absolute way of thinking. It was only relative thinking. Now man was not a creation of God, made in the image of God. He was just another one of the animals that evolved like all the rest of the animals. No difference between man and some other animal except that he was smarter. Along came another voice that speaks to us from the grave today, Karl Marx. Karl Marx came up with an economic system, with the economic system of communism, based on dialectical materialism as the means for providing all men with material abundance. This rejected the biblical principle of private ownership and the biblical principle of profit motivation for elevating the standard of living of people. And Karl Marx came up with a system of economics that simply was all based on the concept, again, that man was a material animal, and if you wave the right things in front of him, he will respond in a desirable way. A fifth man who speaks to us from the grave was George Wellhausen. George Wellhausen said that the Bible was not produced by God, the Holy Spirit, through human authors, but was merely a human record embellished by human imagination. It was a record of the evolution of religion. The Bible was merely pasted together, a series of writings pasted together from various authors. And if there was no absolute authority in spiritual matters in the Bible, it was a record which was subject to human reason and to human evaluation. This morning we come to man number six, and this is probably the greatest agent who interjected poison into the line of human thinking, and consider yourself fortunate to be here this morning to get what I suspect will only be the introductory this morning, and that we will have to follow through tonight. And that man is John Dewey. John Dewey was the greatest agent for the poisoning of the human mind with Satan's human viewpoint concepts that has ever lived, because he dealt in the field of education. And I remind you again, the battle in the final days preceding the return of the Lord is in the field of education and in the field of the teaching of Bible doctrine. Both those areas are under major attack today, and both those areas are areas that Satan is seeking to depress and to dismiss. The teaching of Bible doctrine in an expository fashion is held in disrepute and in contempt and is seldom done in churches. And the concepts of education that have evolved from John Dewey's progressive education concepts has totally destroyed the American public school system and has affected school systems around the world. History has clearly demonstrated that freedom in a society is dependent on an educated citizenry. The founders of our nation knew this, and they knew it well. And so they were very careful to try to make provisions for public education for everybody. An educated citizenry is the only way to preserve the kinds of liberties and freedoms which the world has never imagined or dreamed of, which were made available through the American Constitution. Education, however, has also been the tool of tyrants to establish control over a society. As Stalin once said, that education is the gun, and it is helpful to those who hold the gun, and it is a disaster to those who are on the other end at whom the gun is pointed. Tyrants have always known that education can be used to bring controls over a society. Today, the deterioration and the perversion of public school education in the United States is accompanied by increasing loss of personal freedom in our society, with growth in government controls, and the two are related. as public school education has deteriorated and lost its foundations, its moorings, its orientation to divine viewpoint, so human freedom has increasingly been lost. Because what, as you shall see, is being taught in the public schools is specifically designed to start reducing the kinds of freedom that have characterized American society and to bring in the kinds of tyranny that we have long since left behind us in this country that has characterized nations throughout history. The educational system in our country today is now anti-God, anti-parents, anti-home, and anti-social. That the degree to which it is that varies. It's a little less here in the Bible Belt as it is in some other parts of our country. But make no mistake about it, it is this in whatever part of the country you live in, including ours. It is anti-God, anti-parents, anti-home, and anti-social. The concept of education today, which was inherited from the thinking of John Dewey, is to take a child who is frozen in certain values called middle class values, which means biblical orientation. He is to be unfrozen from those values, and that's the word they use, unfrozen. He is to be unfrozen from the values, from the morals, and from the principles of a biblical society, and he is to be refrozen, and that's the jargon they use, refrozen into a new identity devoted to anti-biblical concepts. This is to be achieved through a grand program of education which was conceived by John Dewey, one of the greatest agents of His Majesty the Devil that ever lived. The people who will understand the information we are going to be dealing with in the next couple of sessions are the people who will flee from the public school system immediately. They will see that system in its current perspective, in its true light, and they will see the subtle devastations that are taking place to their children, which only a few parents are able to counter and to preserve their children from succumbing to the consequences of these influences. John Dewey, he was born in Burlington, Vermont in 1859, and he died in 1952, a 93-year-old dude that was around a long time to create a lot of mischief. He earned a Ph.D. in philosophy at Johns Hopkins University in 1884. In the late 19th century, Johns Hopkins University was the center in the United States for the promotion of economic socialism and the philosophy of secular humanism. Dewey himself, under the influence of his training at Johns Hopkins, became a devoted socialist and a believer in secular humanism. Now that immediately should tell you a lot about the man who is the father of all that is taking place in modern American education, not only on the lower levels, but right on up through the higher levels of the universities and colleges. He was a devoted socialist, and he was a devoted believer in the religion of secular humanism. And all of his thinking proceeds from those two premises. John Dewey based his educational philosophy on Hegel's dialectic method for determining truth through the senses and on Darwin's evolution theory as the source of human life. When Dewey sat down to conceive an educational philosophy, he began with these two premises. One, Hegel's dialectic. Everything is relative. There are no absolutes. Two, Darwin's evolutionary concept. Man is an animal. He has no soul. There is no God, and there's no life after death. And therefore, we are educating an animal in a climate, in a life, in an atmosphere in which there are no absolute truths. In the late 19... Dewey was an atheist, we should mention, who rejected the existence of the human soul and any concept of life after death, and consequently, because man was an animal, there could be no absolutes of moral conduct. In the late 1920s, Dewey visited Russia and was captivated by the newly developed concept of communism, which was evolving in Russia. He saw communism as the solution for providing for human needs and happiness without the strain of competition. Now, immediately, that should tell you something. You know what this man is going to come up with. You know what kind of ideas he's going to project. You know what kind of an educational system he's going to produce. And this is the educational system which is known as American public schools today. He rejected the profit motive as the means for producing a plentiful supply of what people want and need. He ignored the well-demonstrated fact that the standard of living is directly related to individual effort motivated by reward. And it is amazing how many Americans who, as the result of the educational system that they have been under, have lost sight of this. Most Americans do not understand that the standard of living is in direct proportion to the motivation for profit. As the motivation for profit is removed, the standard of living of a society falls. It isn't because Americans are smarter or that they necessarily have more material goods to work with, more natural resources than other nations of the world. There are some nations in the darkness of the backwoods jungles of the world that have infinite resources, but their societies live on an animal level because there is no motivation for producing goods, for producing the things people want, for putting yourself up to come up with an idea in order to be profited. Most of those nations are under dictatorial, under socialistic governmental arrangements, and there is no encouragement for them to put themselves out to be creative. When people are not creative, they are not producing things that increase the standard of life. Many of the things you use today that have improved the American standard of living over the last, in recent years, did not even exist 10 years ago. Many of the vast things that we just take for granted in the electronics world now did not even exist 10 years ago. And the reason they exist now is because somebody came up with an idea and lived in an economic climate where he could take that idea and he had the motivation to run with the idea and to produce something that people would buy and he thereby would profit from their desire for his product. Dewey completely ignored this. He seemed to completely reject this idea that a standard of living is directly related to the motivation that people have through profit to put themselves out to create more things that elevate the standard of living. And the standard of American living today is going down simply because we are discouraging the profit benefit, the encouragement, the motivation that comes from people benefiting by the fruits of their own labors. So he ignored this well-demonstrated principle. He favored, obviously, therefore, the abolition of private property. He championed the welfare state, a welfare state to be run by an intellectual elite. The economic viewpoint of John Dewey was well stated and well reflected by his star pupil and the man who is his successor after he retired, George S. Counts, who had this to say of the economic viewpoint upon which progressive education is based. Dewey's pupil, George Counts, said, quote, "Capitalism has become cruel and inhuman. Traditional ideals in economics, politics, morals, and religion have been rendered totally anachronistic. America has reached a point where competition will have to be replaced by cooperation and private capitalism by some form of socialized economy," unquote. Now, that was said several decades ago. That was said when progressive education was being born, was being formed, and was being implemented, and has now since borne the fruit of the consequences of that very idea. John Dewey subscribed to the ancient pagan philosophy known as pragmatism. Pragmatism means that everything is judged by how well it works, not by any external standards of whether a thing is right or wrong. It doesn't matter whether somebody says a thing is right or wrong. If it works, it's okay. That's the thing that counts. And of course, all socialism and communism is based upon this. Communist nations never, never hesitate to slaughter people by the millions and to murder people literally by the millions if it meets a goal that they're after. That is the thing that counts. Slaughtering those people helps make the system work, and therefore it is acceptable. So things are judged in the light of your present experience apart from any previous value system. The deed was not important, only the end result. And so as the existentialist today has described it, if you want to prove that you exist and that you're somebody and that you're important, here's a little old lady, she's crossing the street. If you take your car and you run her down, it doesn't matter what happened to the old lady. It's only important the fact that you have proven that you're a person who can make things happen and that you exist and that you are aware of yourself and you have a self-awareness. That is the concept of pragmatism. It's the existential philosophy, as we know it today, which says that there are no consequences to your deeds. That's what existentialism is all about. You exist in the moment. What you've done in the past has no effect upon this moment of your life. What you do now has no effect upon the future. That is pragmatism. Now, that should tell you a lot about the American public school system, because it's going to be based upon that concept. And so Dewey believed that sheer educational experimentation and innovations would somehow produce future improvements in the school system and in society. Back to Hegel's principle again. Experimentation. The public schools still do this. They call it innovations. And they're always innovating. Their latest innovation is to put the spring vacation not at Easter time when it's convenient, but a little earlier in the year. That's where it has been for a couple of years. Now they shoot it up there middle of March when it's cold on the Rio Grande and all that. And now but I can tell you that in a short time it's going to be back at Easter, and they're going to announce, we have made a great advancement in the educational system of the city. We're putting spring vacation back at Easter time. This will have several educational benefits, and then it'll go on and tell you that's an innovation. A few years ago, somebody came up with the bright idea, why have 50-minute periods? Let's have 100-minute periods. Somebody said, that's wonderful. Kids can learn a whole lot more in 100 periods than 50, obviously. And so there was this great program within the city of the advancement of the double period, and you had two periods for kids to get bored in a row instead of getting a little break in between, and it was just a wonderful innovation. And now they got all kinds of multiple devices, mechanical devices you can talk to and that you can learn from. And then there was the learning packet. That's a great advancement, the self-teaching packet. You look up an answer, you read a book, you fill this out, and then you go and you check your chart. Wonderful system. We've got a Christian system called ACE, Accelerated Christian Education. It's accelerated baloney. It's kids trying to teach themselves out of their own ignorance. And so this is the whole concept that there's going to be this Hegelian principle, experimentation, innovation, try it, change it, something better. Now, the reason for this, of course, is that all this is smokescreen. About the time that the public school system and the administration sees that parents have just about had it up to their craw and they're really going to come charging into the boardroom, then they come up with an innovation, and the parents, because they're always hopeful, hope springs eternal in the human breast. Hey, that's a good expression right there. Somebody should remember that. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. They always hope that somehow this new innovation is going to straighten it all out. And boy, the parents sit back there, and then they wait, and then the parents realize they've been hoodwinked again. And about the time they're ready to charge up in their indignation, a new innovation comes along. This is all Hegelian. Learn what's going on. Understand that Hegel is the man that they're following, and his poison is what is corrupting, in part, our school system. John Dewey was a lifelong leader in an organization called the League for Industrial Democracy. It's an organization which promoted Fabian socialism in the United States. Fabian socialism is an idea which was developed in England by the Webbs, who was a wealthy man, Beatrice, and I forget the man's name, Webb. The Webbs developed Fabian socialism, which was a gradual change from capitalism and private ownership to state ownership and welfare state. They realized that a prosperous nation like England was not about to go to a bankrupt system like socialism, which had been demonstrated in major ways in the world, particularly like nations like Russia, which can't even raise enough food to feed its people, and can't provide the anywhere near the kind of consumer goods level of standard of living that we commonly enjoy in the United States. And so the web said, we've got to do this gradually. And so Fabian socialism was interjected into England. It has worked beautifully. England, which once was a nation upon whom the sun never set, an empire all over the world, and was held in esteem everywhere, and people who, if they had to be under any kind of master other than their own national leadership, always preferred to be under the British control. That nation is now a rinky-tinky, backwoods, fourth, fifth-rate power in the world, because socialism has done its devastating work in every phase of its national life. And Fabian socialism was the means for bringing it about. Well, this organization that John Dewey was a major leader in was designed, the League for Industrial Democracy was the American expression of that. And the political arm for this, particularly since the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was the Democratic Party. This is why the Democratic Party is in such a frap today. The administration just passed did more than any other administration to throw away all caution to the winds. Up to now, the Democratic Party has always been very careful to shield its socialism. It calls it social programs. John Dewey's word for it was social reforms. Same thing, meant the same thing. And the poor average Joe citizen who's in the party and he votes, he has no idea in the world what the elite in the organization have in mind as they are directing the party's activities. The elite know full well what John Dewey knew and the principle of Fabian socialism. And so the political arm in the United States has been primarily the Democratic Party, though Republicans have been equally involved in many respects. But this is a philosophy. Fabian socialism is the philosophy of the Democratic Party. And that's why suddenly that party was in a panic in the last election, because suddenly people were standing up and saying, don't pay any attention to the candidates. Pay attention now only to the party label, because the candidates represent a philosophy which now has a death grip upon the American nation. And that philosophy of Fabian socialism, if not broken, will destroy us. Thank God the message got through. And people took their eyes off of candidates, and they realized that it was the party that was the problem. The Democratic Party is now in a panic and a shambles, and is seeking now to put on a new image. Same old game they've always played, of hiding behind an image of free enterprise capitalism, but in the back, the manipulating hands are still moving toward John Dewey's Fabian socialism. If you don't understand that, you are going to be a sucker. And you better think it through, and you better think through your own experience, and you better think through the history of the social programs in this country, and you better look and see who's screaming bloody murder now when the country is finally saying, we cannot continue paying for things that the government has no business supplying to people, because the government can't supply this unless the government steals it from people who have produced by their efforts, and we are forcing them to use the fruits of their labors to be dispensed to those who have not produced these things. The political arm has done its job very well indeed. In 1919, Dewey was the founder of the New School for Social Research, which sought to implement this idea of Fabian socialism, and it turned out teachers, lawyers, and writers who were oriented to socialism. John Dewey held in contempt the traditional individualism and the biblical values upon which American society had functioned and become great and prosperous. He said, it doesn't make any difference how far the United States has come over other nations, there are still people in our country who are poorer than other people. And of course, you know, those who are ignorant of history and of economy are always able to hoodwink people by pointing back to how terrible things were when capitalism took over in modern times. The poor children who had to work long hours, the long hours that people work, the sweatshops and all the emotional code words. But one of the things they never tell you is that until capitalism came and began giving people jobs, even under long hours of work and hard work, they were animals scratching an empty field to try to survive, like you see in some primitive societies today. Don't ever forget that what needed improving under 19th century capitalism was a whole lot better than what the human race had ever experienced until that time. Now, the worst thing about John Dewey, and you have to have the background of this man before we delve into the consequences in detail, the worst thing about John Dewey was that he was a member and a leading force in the American Humanist Association, which exists to this day. The American Humanist Association put out a manifesto in 1933. It is now called Manifesto 1. It was a brief statement, 15 propositions, and it was signed by 34 influential people. Humanist Manifesto was the program for the social reform of the United States. Now, you got to translate social reform, or Democratic Party word, social programs. You got to translate that into Fabian socialism. And you have to translate that into the religion of secular humanism. These brief 15 statements said this: it held to an organic view of life. That means man was a material animal, and that's all. It therefore rejected, it said, the dualism of mind and body, by which they meant soul and body. Man has no connection with any quality of a spiritual nature. He is just a material creature. They also declared that man is a part of nature and has emerged as the result of a continuous process, which said that man was a product of evolution. It also said that it viewed man with all his faculties as part of one all-embracing natural order with the animal world. And that's secularism. That man is just part of the animal world. It is just life here. And it also declared that man was the highest product of the natural processes, with nothing above him but his own aspirations, which was their way of expressing atheism. There wasn't anybody above man, just himself. Now, in 1973, Humanist Manifesto 2 was proclaimed. It was a more extensive document of 4,000 words, and it was signed by more than 100 prominent people, including philosophers, scientists, religious leaders, and educators from several countries. This expression of humanism spelled out in considerable details the views of secular humanism. In this document, there was affirmed the human right to birth control, to abortion, to divorce, to complete sexual freedom, to euthanasia, and privacy. It stressed the need for freedom of the individual, by which it meant the welfare state. It stressed participatory democracy, by which it meant socialism. It stressed the need for minimum guaranteed annual income, for universal education, and worldwide ecological planning, by which it meant world government. It opposed war, nationalism, and any dogmatic and authoritarian religion that places revelation, God, and creed above human need and experience. That is, reason was above scripture. It sought the goal of the fulfillment of the potential growth of each human personality. But it sought that growth without God, which is the only way that anybody can reach his full potential. It called for the use of reason and intelligence in building a world community in which all sectors of the human family can participate. World government concept. I'm going to read several definitions to you that have been written by secular humanists and others to try to crystallize for humanism. You're always hearing about secular humanism. And I have the feeling that most Christians talk about it, and they don't really have a clear idea in their mind what it's all about. And once you understand secular humanism, then we can go back to Mr. Dewey, and you will know where he came from, and you will know why we are where we are in the school system today, and why Americans are where they are intellectually and in the society in which we live today. One definition from Corliss Lamont, in The Independent Mind, quote, "Humanism stands for the continuous and wholehearted enjoyment of experience, sensory, cultural, and spiritual, in this one and only life, and for the unceasing progress of humanity toward greater wisdom and happiness, freedom, and beauty." Another definition by Oliver L. Reiser and Baldwin Davies in Planetary Democracy say, quote, "Scientific humanism is the doctrine that men, through the use of intelligence, directing the institutions of democratic government, can create for themselves, without aid from supernatural powers, a rational civilization in which each person enjoys security and finds cultural outlets for whatever normal human capacities and creative energies he possesses." And then in The Humanist, a publication, July-August 1968, gives this definition, quote, "Humanism is a way of life which relies on human capacities and natural and social resources. Humanists see man as a product of this world of evolution and human history and acknowledge no cosmic mind or supernatural purpose or force." And then one more from Texas Tech Law Review, Volume 10, statement by John W. Whitehead and John Conlon, quote, and these men are Christians, "Humanism is a doctrine centered solely on human interests or values. Humanism deifies man collectively and individually, whereas theism worships God. Moreover, while humanism draws its values and absolutes from the finite reasoning of relativistic man, theism has received its values and absolutes through the revelation of the infinite deity or creator. Therefore, secular humanism is a religion whose doctrine worships man as the source of all knowledge and truth, whereas theism worships God as the source of all knowledge and truth." Unquote. Now, looking at the educational philosophy of John Dewey, we find that he taught philosophy at the universities of Michigan, Minnesota, and Chicago. But then he made his big move in 1904. He joined the faculty and became the head of the Teachers College at Columbia University in New York. He became the professor, held the chair of educational philosophy, and now the fat was in the fire. This man, who for years had been preparing, whose orientation had been, as we have been describing it, to secular humanism and all that that connotes, has now assumed a position that is a key point of influence for the next 50 years upon American education, upon the training of teachers, and upon Western civilization. For 50 years, he controlled the whole ball of wax. He introduced the concept, which was revolutionary, that the public schools were to be used to bring about social changes to a humanist society under socialism. It was to be done, of course, gradually on the Fabian social pattern, but no longer were schools to be viewed as some place that you send your child to learn how to read English, how to do numbers, and how to be able to write and to communicate that way. Dewey said that is secondary. Henceforth, public schools must be used as the agents of social reform, because if we can capture one generation of children in the public schools, get them devoted to the concepts of socialism, get them devoted to the principles of secular humanism, we've got the nation. Now, he was right. And it is only because this nation has been so steeped in biblical principles that that has been fought and resisted. And it has not made as dramatic progress as it has made in other parts of the world. Dewey's educational philosophy viewed man, of course, as a merely biological animal who responds to influences in his environment. To Dewey, the child was a living organism which is a stimulus-response machine, and so he can be conditioned to desired reactions. Get that. Dewey said every pupil in your class is a stimulus-response machine. That's all. He's just a little animal, and you give him a certain stimulus, and it'll create a certain response. Our job is to find the stimuli which will create the responses we want, which will create the socialist world that we think is the world that the American society should pursue. This conditioning was to be through material means or through words used to create certain emotional responses. Now, you know how that works. I found that I have conditioned my little dog that when she hears me rattling my car keys, she knows it's time to go riding. And every morning we take a ride down to one of the public schools, kind of see what's going on, then come home again. It's just sort of a ritual that we have. And as soon as she hears those keys rattling, she comes tearing out, no matter where she is in the house, and she stands by the door, ready to go. And she knows just where to go, jump up on a seat, she takes her place, she looks around, checks the traffic, and we drive along to school. She used to insist on helping me drive. She used to nudge over the minute she would, and it was interesting. The minute she saw me drop Heidi off at school, then she would move over and sit in my lap. Not that Heidi was doing it before, but I mean, she just said, nobody in here, and she just got cozy. And I, for weeks, I stood there driving with this character sitting right in my lap in front of the wheel, until I saw a policeman go by one day and I saw his eyes follow me. And I thought, I better not do that anymore. So I had to recondition her not to sit in my lap while we're driving. And this is a conditioned response of an animal. Tinkle the keys, come running, time to ride in the car. And this can be done in a variety of ways. It can also be done with words. There are certain words that you can use. Words that make you hoppin' mad. Dummy. Stupid. Or stop acting like Jimmy Crinkle. See, now right away, man, you want to, that makes you mad. Those are emotionally charged words. And you can condition an animal to have a certain response. Bingo. Well, he can be conditioned as an individual, or he can be conditioned as a group. That's called the peer mentality. He can be conditioned by his peer group to have a certain response. And so the group is given certain influences, certain ideas, which then it imposes on others. You wonder why teenagers do what they do? Many of them do things they don't want to do, but they do it because they've been conditioned by the peer group response. Their gang does this. Their gang wears this. The gang acts like this. Therefore, they have to act the same way. Dewey saw that. Dewey said, we'll create not only individual responses in these animals we have in our classroom, we'll create collective responses so that these animals as a group will force everyone in the group to act in a certain way, and nobody will dare to step out of the pressure of the group. Now these modification, and that's what it's called, these modification techniques have been promoted under various code words. You perhaps know some of these code words and have never realized that it's John Dewey's boys who invented these code words as a means of conditioning the human animal, which they then transferred into the educational system to condition American children into a socialist world. These words are psychodrama, role-playing, role reversal, soliloquy, group dynamics, encounter group sessions, sensitivity training sessions. These are some of the words which are used to convey this conditioning of the animal technique. Now, John Dewey rejected the biblical principle that the knowledge of God is the beginning of all wisdom and is the foundation of all genuine education. Dewey was indeed one of Satan's key agents in preparing Western civilization through his educational philosophies for the terrible conditions that will be accepted in the tribulation world to come. He thought he was creating a utopia on earth. And please do not forget that he was just as sincere as could be. He was a kindly man. If you had met him, you would have seen he was a kindly gentleman. You would have liked him. He really thought he was creating a utopia for mankind. Now that brings us to a quick summary of specifically John Dewey's educational principles. And they are these. One, he said, we are going to pursue the expression and cultivation of individuality. That meant no regulations and requirements imposed from above. This resulted in doing one's own thing in rebellion against controls of God and society in time. He made an autonomous man with no control factor anywhere in the universe, the expression and cultivation of individuality, and it has borne its bitter fruit. Dewey's second principle was called free activity, as opposed to external discipline of a structured curriculum. This resulted in children engaging in the classroom in chaotic activities which wasted their school time and which failed to enable them to secure a mastery of the basic skills of education. That's why kids don't learn to read. They were ignorant, immature children deciding what they should study. Dewey said, you let the child decide what to study. He said, education has been teacher-oriented. We're going to make it child-oriented. And the child will be given a nice wide area of the classroom, and he will decide what he should study and what he should do. And if he wants to play, that's one of the ways he learns a lot. Principle number three was learning through experience, as opposed to learning through the study of a textbook and the information from a teacher and a drill in the class to memorize. Well, this resulted in the lack of a frame of reference to make judgments beyond one's own ignorance. Now, you take a look at some of these little midgets sitting around here. How much smarts do they have about knowing how to interpret their own experience? And Dewey said they can learn through their experience, and they'll know how to analyze and learn from that. The only experience they learn is that some guy hits his little sister and she learns and hit him back. That's what she learns by experience. They don't know how to interpret that experience. They're devoid, therefore, of intellectual and cultural heritage of Western civilization. Principle number four was acquiring skills as a means of attaining ends which have direct appeal. You don't learn to read unless you've got some need for reading. You don't learn to count unless you've got a reason for counting. This was opposed, you see, to learning the essential skills of the three R's in the history of mankind. Well, this resulted in the lack of basic skills for functioning independently in society to enable you to handle personal needs. Why is it that most high school kids can't balance their own checkbook? They can't fill out a job application. Right here, folks. Acquiring skills is a means of attaining ends which have a direct appeal. Don't learn it until you need it. Point number five was making the most of the opportunities of present life, the here and the now, as opposed to preparation for future both here on earth and in eternity. Well, this resulted in the demands that we know of today as instant gratification. Gratification for things that you haven't even earned or tried to earn. The now generation. I want it now, and I have a right to have it now, and I'll take it from you by violent means if you try to deny it to me. This is what our government is up against now. It isn't just that we're trying to cut the budget down. We've got a society who's been educated to this concept of Dewey that I have a right to have it now, and you don't have a right to deny it to me. And they have been handing out free money to freeloaders who now are so addicted to that free money that they're not about to be willing to permit the government to stop handing it out. And you can just watch for more violence. The violence has already been directed against the president. When they can't stop him there, the violence is going to be directed toward those of you who have something that these people want. Point number six was the acquaintance with a changing world, as opposed to the absolute values and standards from God. This resulted in rejecting the biblical economic system of free enterprise capitalism and toward the reception of socialism. Materialism is the basis of all human relationships. So that's what he meant by acquaintance with a changing world instead of with absolute values and absolute standards based upon biblical concepts. Now this has borne a very bitter fruit. And tonight, I'm going to tell you about how it has borne its bitter fruit right here in part of the program in the ministry of Berean Memorial Church, as we have seen the fruit of Dewey progressive education concepts destroying an area of ministry productive and effective. But once people were suckered into these concepts, Satan had them by the jugular vein. Don't miss it this evening. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the fact that the Word of God tells us what's coming